This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello and welcome to the Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Cindy Yu and today I'm joined by Michael Gove and James Heal. Slashing winter fuel allowance, keeping the two-child benefits cap, cutting foreign aid, cutting the civil service, axing NHS bureaucracy and potentially almost halving welfare spending. Michael, these are policies that Conservative governments dream of, right? And yet it is Keir Starmer that is bringing them in. Is the Prime Minister, in fact, a Tory?
I do ask myself, given that all of these policy decisions have been taken since I became editor of The Spectator, is Keir Starmer trying to impress The Spectator editorial team with just how right-wing he can be? And you're right, it is a remarkable litany of Conservative goals that would have most Tories, if they, you know, they take off the tribal markings and the partisan blinkers, gasping in admiration. I do have to provide an element of a reality check, though, in that some of what has been announced is headline rather than detail. But nevertheless, so far, I find myself much against my will, and it's painful to acknowledge it, but giving two cheers for Keir Starmer.
This is probably the recommendation that he did not need or want. But James, how do you think he's managed to get away with all of this, both with the civil service, but also, importantly, with his Labour Party members?
Well, it was Disraeli who said about the Conservatives, you know, they were Tory men with Whig measures. And similarly, these are Labour men with Tory measures in some ways, perhaps. Because I think the reason why is expediency and necessity. As one member of the Shadow Cabinet said to me, the facts of life for Conservative. And so for them, it's very much, look, the fiscal situation is dire. We've got to come in and do these things. And I would make a distinction perhaps between Tory principle and Treasury pragmatism. And a lot of what the Treasury proposes, and say the family farms tax, for instance, well, ideas have been kicking around for years. And so the Treasury has its own biases. And I think that the initial failure to have a convincing mission prior to the sort of Sue Gray defenestration meant that the Treasury, what Nigel Lawson called the central department, filled that gap, stepped into it and provided a lot of the thinking that's underpinning some of these decisions. Since then, what we've actually seen as well is necessity and this talk of welfare. And of course, welfare cuts are always proposed as a way of doing this. As Michael says, they proposed it. I'll be interested to see the reality of it. Mm. But I do think it says something about also not just perhaps how the Labour Party have maybe moved to the right, but also how the last Tory government was the Labour dream, you know, mass migration, national yes, industrial true. Strategy.
If smoking I was being cynic. Ban.
But the reason being, of course, is that they're doing these things because of pragmatism and because they can see a lot of them are popular in the polls. Putting foreign aid into the defence budget is something that gets 70% approval. Obviously, everyone loathes NHS bureaucrats and probably anything more unpopular than journalists and estate agents. So I think that it's going to be something we'll see how much of it actually is borne out in reality. And I would urge, you know, listeners to reflect on the point John McTurnan made earlier in the week, which was that actually, you know, Blair Brown, for instance, for all the sort of right-wing noises, we're doing a redistributive project. And I suspect the same will be true of this, which is actually at the end of this parliament, we'll be saying, you know, there have been fiscal transfers, etc.
In a historical context, it has been the case that actually Labour governments in the past have done some quite right-wing things. Mm. So it was the case that Jim Callaghan introduced a migration policy when he was Home Secretary and Harold Wilson was Prime Minister, influenced by Enoch Powell, actually, that was to the right of where the Tories were at the time. It was also the case that monetarism was not ushered into the British economy by Margaret Thatcher, but by Jim Callaghan and Dennis Healey when they were dealing with the grim financial circumstances post-1976. So in both those cases, you had a Labour government enacting bracingly right-wing policies because of the facts on the ground, exactly as James mentions. Even during the late 1970s, the Northern Ireland Secretary, who was toughest towards the IRA, was Roy Mason, a Labour politician. So there is a strain of Labour realism and old right Labour thinking that is comfortable with the exercise of state power, but in a way which is closer to the instincts, one might argue, of White Van Man, Workington Man, however you describe it, the sort of no-nonsense figure probably from the industrial sector who does believe in Labour values of solidarity, but who also has no time for bourgeois woke nonsense.
Of course, who is Keir Starmer's favourite Labour Prime Minister? It's Harold Wilson. And so this week you've seen him with the NHS, talk about the AI, very much a modern 60 years on version of the white heat of technology. So being comfortable with progressive technocracy in some ways, but also, as Michael says, talking about defence spending. And again, that's the point about expediency. You know, frankly, no British Prime Minister, I think, could sit there and let defence spending bobble along at around 2%. Mm. That, hence the push towards a closer 3%.
The most difficult historical parallel, though, for Keir Starmer is the government of Ramsay MacDonald. Because again, you had a situation where Ramsay MacDonald and his Chancellor, Philip Snowden, came to power in 1929. Then changes in America, global economic turbulence, rising right-wing sentiment in Europe. A number of things all came together. And in the end, Ramsay MacDonald and Philip Snowden decided on economic measures. So bracing that the Labour Party broke apart and they went into government with the Tories, forming a national government. Now, I don't think it's the case that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are going to go into government with Kemi Badenoch and Mel Stride. I don't think that is going to happen. But it is the case that all of the changes that you listed right at the beginning, Cindy, will be very difficult for some in the Labour Party to take. So Annalise Dodds, of course, has already resigned over the aid cut to fund defence. There's wider disquiet across the party about that. And it will be the case that on welfare, if the level of cuts which have been heralded are put through, Liz Kendall may well find herself in a position where there is a significant section of backbench opinion, and indeed opinion, Labour opinion, outside Parliament that says, look, fiscal responsibility, yes, but why is it that it's the poorest in our society who are bearing the burden at this point?
Michael, have you been surprised by how much tolerance the party seems to have had for these different policies? Do you think it's time limited?
Well, I have been. I've been impressed, actually, by the relative discipline of most of the Labour Party. I think that Annalise Dodd's resignation was, in a way, foreseeable, and it was also clear that she wanted to cause the minimum fuss, but she just felt that she couldn't.
Because she did it after the big summit
exactly.
of the day anyway.
She kept counsel until after Starmer had been to see Trump, and it was much more in sorrow than in anger, but she felt that her own position was untenable. So I think there's a respect for the dignified way in which she chose to leave. But on potential welfare cuts, there have actually been some outrighters, Labour politicians who've been from the backbenches arguing that it's absolutely right to bear down on burgeoning costs, particularly with disability benefits. And also, we had just this week, in another area where Labour are pushing ahead in a manner which the Tories, myself included, didn't, which is planning reform, we've had a Labour MP, Chris Curtis, the Member of Parliament for Milton Keynes North, arguing for the dismantling of inherited EU law and environmental protections in order to drive through new infrastructure. And his comments have been approvingly retweeted by Dominic Cummings. So if you have a Labour MP who is Dom's new hero, that does tell you that there is a spectrum of opinion on the Labour backbenches, which is far broader than one might have imagined at the time of Starmer's election. But for every Chris Curtis, you will also have a Richard Bergen or a Rachel Maskell.
Nadia Whittam.
And Nadia Whittam. So I think there are difficulties ahead for Labour. One other thing, though, that I would say is that many of the people who were selected as candidates this time round, people like Mike Tapp in Dover or Al Carnes in Birmingham, are people who were carefully selected by Labour Together, Morgan McSweeney and others. And these were the people who'd been the storm troopers even before Starmer was leader. These were the people who'd been in the trenches in the fight against the Corbynistas during Labour's wilderness years. So they're tempered in that battle. And so they're likely to remain relatively steady under fire. But are there enough of them for Starmer to feel confident? I don't know.
And Ian McArdle said that the Labour Party was like a bird, and he'd a left wing and a right wing to fly. That is very much not Morgan McSweeney's approach thus far. And I was chatting to a new Intake MP, who I very much confidently expect will be a minister very shortly, saying that there's a lot of Sue people sitting around, Sue people in terms of the government, particularly the Minister of State, a couple in the Cabinet, etc. Remember what we might call the soft left. So I suspect that next reshuffle is going to be fascinating how it rebalances, because... As Michael says there, I mean, it depends on who are the most vocal voices, etc. And I don't think currently right now the left in Parliament is particularly, it's lacking sort of generals, as it were. There aren't many sort of elite people in Cabinet. And that's something that most Labour prime ministers normally have quite a considerable contingent on the left. Tony Blair, of course, I think we forget how, in some ways, how indulgent he was of the Corbynite left, and how Jeremy Corbyn, of course, rebelled hundreds of times against his party. And that's the striking thing, is how much crushed the left is very much the basis of some of the people around Keir Starmer's politics.
Michael, do you think this is a reflection of Starmer's personality in terms of how ruthless and pragmatic he has been in any case in his own personal career, and now kind of projected onto his policy?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. So the revealed way of working for Keir Starmer is to arrive, to take the approach of, why can't we all be friends? And then the iron enters his soul. So he assumed the leadership of the Labour Party with the support of some who'd supported Corbyn, actually. And initially, he wanted to be friends with Len McCluskey, the hard left leader of the Unite Union, and others. He relatively quickly realised that these people were going to give no quarter. So he decided to man up, as it were, took them on, and subsequently in reshuffles demoted those on the soft left and encouraged those who were not necessarily always Blairite, but certainly more centrist or even more right wing. And that was how his grip became firmer on the Labour Party. And I think James is right that in government, the facts, the difficulty of pushing through change, the need to make economies in order to invest in the areas that are current priorities, all that has meant that he's become more determined. Another thing as well, people close to Keir Starmer say that he's not sentimental at all about either the Labour Party or indeed other institutions. That when he took over as DPP, he said, you know, the purpose of the Crown Prosecution Service is to prosecute. Yes, I may have been a human rights lawyer and a defender and so on, but here, what we're going to do is make sure that this institution does what it's supposed to do. And I think he takes the same approach towards government. I think he's impatient with those who are inclined to place a halo around the idea of public service as an amazing moral good in itself. His view is people pay their taxes because they expect certain level of delivery. I want to ensure that persists, because I do, Keir Starmer, have a redistributive heart, and I do have a concern for the very poorest. But that concern is not going to be delivered on unless we make sure that the machinery works better. So that seems to be the approach that he's taking. And I think in that sense, he may well disappoint many of those on the emotional or romantic left who thought that he was one of them, who thought that he was, someone in a footstroke Kinnock tradition.
I mean, to point about parliamentary discipline, I mean, I think it's always much easier at the beginning of the parliament. You know, everyone still has the prospect of high office lured in front of them, and they haven't made as many enemies accrued at them at the start. Hence why, of course, I think the coalition government was very disciplined in some respects, you know, at the start of it, in terms of getting that sort of what you might call austerity, you might disagree, but that financial mission through and held pretty firmly for 5 years. So there is that. But I do think what you can already see forming is going to be Labour's electoral winning coalition at the next election, how they chose to fight it. And clearly, I would say that the 40-odd MPs in those rural seats who weren't expected to win are not going to be part of that. How are they going to act, given that basically you've got the next 4.5 years where they can probably hope to rise to maybe Minister of State or junior cabinet level? Are they going to remain how disciplined, how noisy are they going to be, or try and distinguish themselves? And my colleague Katie Balls has got a very good piece in this week's magazine talking about the different factions already starting to form. And I do think, though, that it's going to be much more Morgan McSweeney's politics that informs the decisions the government's making, and there's going to be more urban politics, there's going to be much more about working men as sort of getting people's more money in their pocket and a return on their investment, as Michael says, which public sector reform, improving public sectors. So some people might pay higher taxes over the next time in the next 4 or 5 years, but overall get more bang for your buck in terms of public service delivery.
And James, forgive me for being a bit perhaps naive about this question, but is this a way to run a government, to be this kind of pragmatic, pick and choose, almost kind of no ideological underpinning here? Is that a way to kind of lead a political movement when it doesn't seem like we understand what he stands for?
Well, I think that sometimes strategic ambiguity can be a very effective thing in high office, and perhaps some recent prime ministers exercise the high art. I think that Keir Starmer is in recent months been auditioning a few sort of political ideologies, almost like sort of Mufti or something, going into the fancy dress box and trying on different things. There's been a flirtation with Blue Labour. There's been talk of different economic approaches. So there was growth was the big thing at the beginning of the year. Actually, if you look at what he was saying in his speech this week, it was much more securonomics, much more security in the dignity of work. And these are all different elements and different shades of Keir Starmer's character. You know, obviously he's very proud of where he comes from. And you remember, of course, he bristled during the election when he perceived GB News viewers were laughing at his father. Actually, it was more Keir Starmer's rhetoric they were laughing at. So I do think it's just emphasising different bits of his character and different points in the parliament. But I do think the next election, it's going to be about working, quote unquote, working people. Mm. And I think an unsentimental, unromantic attachment is such a, can be a very good thing for Keir Starmer, particularly contrasted with his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, who was very much of the why can't we get along romantic school of thought. Actually, when it comes to it, sometimes a bit of pragmatism could have perhaps saved the Labour Party from the fate of the 20th century, which was a endless story of defeat from the jaws of victory. And why, of course, the last century was two thirds dominated by Conservative governments.
And now, Michael, in your first answer, you admitted kind of regretfully liking some of the stuff that's going on at the moment. What would your metrics for success be going ahead? What are the things that you'll be looking out for to say, okay, he actually is doing things that I like, or he's just appealing on a surface level?
Well, first on welfare, he has to pass the Fraser-Nelson test. Is it the case that he can correctly ensure that those people who can work but are not working are back in the labour market? That's the first thing. So overall, reducing the size of the welfare bill, but doing so in a way which ensures that we properly incentivise work and properly deal with the corruption that's existed in disability benefits. The second test on planning will be the Robert Jenrick test, which is, can he be as radical as Robert Jenrick was going to be in his planning bill without it being derailed by a coalition of local politicians and nervous backbenchers. Then on defence, I think it has to be the Ernie Bevin test, which is, can he make sure that British defence capability grows and that Britain is playing a central role in shaping Western security? Then on the economy, I think it would have to be the Dennis Healey test, which is, while still having his heart beat on the left, can he ensure that international markets can have confidence restored in the management of the economy? And then on discipline within the Labour Party, it has to be the Bob Mellish test. Bob Mellish was Labour's deputy chief whip in the past, and he was someone who would brook no dissent. And in his distinctive Bermondsey Cockney accent, would let people who were voting against the whip know exactly what he thought of them. So these are all figures from Labour's past, apart from Fraser, who's a figure of everyone's future, who will be sitting in judgment on Keir Starmer to see if he manages to pass those tests.
And of course, Bob Mellish thereafter went on to become the chairman of the London Docklands Development Corporation. And so I think that's sometimes perhaps illustrative of the fact that, you know, having tribal Labour loyalties, pushing a sort of redistributive social democracy aligned vision, but also embracing supply side reform. So supply side social democracy, I think, is very much what the likes of, you know, Chris Curtis, etc., are pushing. And I do think perhaps, I mean, I was chatting to a former Tory aide in the last government yesterday, and they were just saying there's so much political space on planning that they could do. And I think that the fact that maybe Labour can go even further, and I think that What the Labour Growth Group is serving the purpose of is a bit like the Free Enterprise Group at the beginning of the 2010 government, which is urging a stronger line. Rachel Reeves can go even further and make the most of this space. And the fact that the Tories are still working out how to respond, I think, shows that now is the time to press home that advantage for Labour's perspective over the next 1 or 2 years before, of course, we get the findings of the exciting policy reviews coming out in the next couple of weeks or so.
Well, we're all waiting for. James and Michael, thank you so much.